Hello, everyone, and welcome to Film Strips, the podcast that would just like to say, well, at least it doesn't have, he isn't named Louis Cipher here. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Roger Stone, and this will be my last episode for quite some time. Am I right, folks? No, I am Andrew Carnegie, sir, and we are a very serious and dignified podcast, and totally didn't date when we recorded this episode at all.
No. I mean, it's not like you could go back and take a look when Roger Stone was sentenced to prison and be able to see when this episode was recorded.
Wait a second, Dave. You know that thing we talked about before we started recording, when we both agreed that we think we're helping each other, but we're making it worse?
Yeah.
I think we're doing it now.
Damn.
Quick, why don't we introduce ourselves and the show?
So yes, this is indeed Film Strips, the podcast in which each and every episode we take a look at a film, dissect it, talk about it, get into the nuance and subtext of it. The only thing, aside from the fact that you all need to be forewarned that spoilers will happen throughout the episode, is that each and every film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we discussed the preceding episode. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time on this little program of ours?
The accent. Last week, we were looking at Tom Hanks, written and directed by film 1996's That Thing You Do, which I think in a lot of ways was a swingin' romp, a very, shall we say, pale look at American nostalgia. But I think overall, the film you and I enjoyed probably more than we often do.
Well, I mean, we have films we love, and yes, certainly we have films we hate, and to be fair, it might seem like we were like that one more so than usual, only because the film that immediately preceded that one, boy, did we really have a lot of hatred for. So,
well, yes. And I mean, the interesting thing in doing this week to week is that sometimes our impression of a film is very much colored by the film that came before. I underline color because that is something else that this week's film has in common with That Thing You Do, in addition to performance by Charlize Theron. We have followed her to this week's film, 1997's The Devil's Advocate.
Yes, a film which is sort of a cornucopia of returning players to the show. Because on one hand, not only is Charlize Theron there, we've also got Al Pacino back in this one, along with...
Hoo-ah!
Exactly.
And he's in full post-Scent of a Woman hoo-ah mode.
Oh, absolutely. But that's not all, because in the director's chair this time, we have not the one, the only, Taylor Hackford, returning from White Nights.
Yes, a.k.a. Baryshnikov in the N-word.
Yeah, and then there's the cinematographer, whose name I'm going to toss over to Andrew to pronounce, because I know I'm going to screw it up.
Andrzej Bartkowiak, which might be wrong, but I'm very confident.
Yes, but he is the one who shot Prizzy's Honor, and also went on to direct a little film by the name of Street Fighter, The Legend of Chun-Li, which we also looked at relatively recently on the show. So, yeah, that brings him up to three, and that also brings Al Pacino up to three. They're not in the lead, but, you know, they're making headway pretty quickly on this little show of ours.
You're also forgetting somebody else, David.
Oh, yes, and who might that be?
Returning to this film from his small role in The Hunt for Red October, we get David's favorite actor, Jeffrey Jones. And we'll get into why David loves him so much.
That bloody scumbag.
But, all right, I think we're getting a little on inside baseball. I think we firmly establish that, yes, there are a lot of ways that this film is a coming home party for some, and a coming out party for Keanu Reeves as well. But, I mean, you and I, we are children of the 80s. I think The Devil's Advocate certainly has a certain role it plays in our minds, but especially younger or even older viewers may not be as, shall we say, fixated on The Devil's Advocate as we. All the more reason that, Dave,
yes,
maybe now is a good time for you to give us the rundown.
The Devil's Advocate is director Taylor Hackford's 1997 horror legal thriller starring Keanu Reeves, Charlize Theron, and Al Pacino. Adapted to the screen by writers Jonathan Lemkin and Tony Gilroy from the 1990 novel by Andrew Niederman, the film tells the tale of Kevin Lomax, a young hotshot lawyer from Florida who is headhunted by a major New York firm headed up by the mysterious John Milton. As Kevin and his wife Mary settle into their new life, the pair are confronted by the amorality of the new environment they found themselves in, as well as the possibility that John Milton isn't all he seems. Released to mixed reviews, The Devil's Advocate was a financial success overall, but did modest box office in North America. Coming up after Film Strips, a repeat broadcast of both episodes of the Lawrence Welk Show and Soul Train crossover event.
Well, David, there are a lot of different angles that one can approach the devil's advocate from. And I mean, generally, you and I have some discussion beforehand about a certain genre or a certain stylistic mode that a film occupies, kind of contextualizing the thing. But we talk about the production context in that. I think you brought up something far more interesting than all of the things I think we could talk about. Vis-a-vis this film's genre, or, you know, Al Pacino at this point in his career, and so on. I think, in the interest of not boring our listeners by talking about stuff that we've already rehashed, I think, maybe we have a new angle of looking at it, and that is in the form of the sudden explosion of popularity in legal fiction from the 1980s onward.
Yeah, and let's be clear here. When I say explosion, it's not like the legal thriller was anything new, even by the time the 1980s rolled around. It had been part of pop culture for some time throughout the 20th century, and likely, if my, although I can't speak to this with any authority, certainly probably even before that, in at least American literature and drama.
Well, I mean, you look at an early film, though, like, say, 12 Angry Men, for instance, which, funny enough, right before I moved away from Waterloo, I auditioned to be a juror, got the part, knowing full well I couldn't be in it. I just wanted to see if I could, because I was that insecure.
Okay.
But, like, a story like that is, it's set within a, I guess, quote-unquote, legal framework. But I think there's something very different and something that aims to tell a more universal kind of story than what we see from, like, approximately the 80s onward. Because it seems with these kinds of films, and certainly in the case of this one, there is that emphasis almost reveling in the technical jargon and that focus on procedure. I guess it's the difference between watching Bullet versus watching a more procedural detective film. You know, it comes down to how many scenes are there of people filling out paperwork.
Well, sort of, yeah. Because, I mean, certainly where I was going wasn't so much something like 12 Angry Men, but even television dramas like Perry Mason or Ironside to that angle. You know, these sort of precursors where, yeah, you have the crusading defense lawyer or prosecutor who's, you know, taking on the crime.
Don't forget Matlock.
And, of course, Matlock there. And, you know, that one's a very sort of stagey type approach to it. And certainly, you can kind of understand why legal dramas were very much big appeal to actors in many ways. Because there is sort of a meta quality of it in the sense that basically lawyers as performers, as almost directors, where you're in charge of a case and you're playing to an audience, the jury or the judge or whoever it may be in this instance.
Well, yeah, and everything about a legal case is argumentative, you know, it's two sides trying to present a stronger argument. Full disclosure, I work in the law, so there may be a few snarkier things I have to say about this movie. But I mean, there's sort of that gag, though, where TV law is not the law, right? And that's where we get ideas like, oh, did you know that if you ask an undercover cop, if they're an undercover cop, they have to tell you? Or the idea that during closing statements, you know, you can call a surprise witness and, like, reveal that you've been carrying the handgun that was the real murder weapon. Stuff like that. And I mean, you know, it's easy to goof on. I think, though, that generally you see stories that kind of try and play it straighter. And so it becomes sort of an extension of the detective mystery, where it's not so much, can you solve the case, but can you figure out the verdict?
Well, absolutely. And that's sort of where the genre was for a good chunk of time. However, I think it's worth bringing up the late 80s into the 90s and certainly into basically the early 2000s as sort of a distinct period. Because, again, as growing up, it certainly felt like this genre exploded in ways that that has certainly not been the case since at the end of that sort of heyday. Occasionally we'll get things like The Lincoln Lawyer and that, but not to the same, you know, sort of churning it out degree as we'd seen. Because here's the thing, I'm going to read you a list of titles, not a complete list, of films that came out in the 90s that were legal thrillers here, folks.
Okay.
So we had The Firm, The Client, The Pelican Brief, The Rainmaker, A Few Good Men, Guilty as Sin, Rules of Engagement, Burden of Proof, Philadelphia, A Civil Action, The Chamber, Presumed Innocent, Primal Fear, A Time to Kill. And we should note here, but this doesn't also include things such as comedies like My Cousin Vinny or sort of adjacent films like Double Indemnity, where they're not really legal thrillers as such, but the law itself becomes a sort of major sticking point as part of the plot.
Don't forget The General's Daughter. It's about military law.
Well, that's where Rules of Engagement also comes in. But the point
being,
and
A Few Good Men. Right.
Absolutely.
I mean, let's not forget that that's the film that gives us one of the most famous courtroom scenes in terms of like the cultural memory.
Well, absolutely. And the thing is, though, you're quite right, Andrew, in noting that there seems to be a different emphasis with these sort of legal films at this point. And part of it's probably, and again, this is pure speculation on my part because I am not familiar with the literary version of the genre, but I think John Grisham, it's kind of hard to mistake how he really became sort of a dominant force in that kind of fiction, certainly in the 80s and 90s, and so many of those films mentioned there are based on works of his.
Yeah, and like I don't want to sneer at John Grisham or make a distinction between high and low art, but I mean, John Grisham writes novels that are very accessible. Like, they're potboilers, I think, when you get down to it, and there's absolutely nothing wrong or pejorative about that. I think he's also very skilled in using just enough legal concepts that it feels smarter than most airport novels that you can buy. And I think there's something, though, that audiences find pleasurable about that, even if it's just in the sense of, well, I can follow along with this, and that's kind of personally validating. But that coincides with, I think, even people who don't avidly read or shop in airport bookstores, there's also a couple events that suddenly make everybody in North America realized that what happens in a courtroom is very theatrical and can be very dramatic. And the 24/7 news cycle that sort of rises concurrent with that very much creates that sense of the courtroom as the stage.
Well, absolutely. And the big events that sort of in the mid to late 90s that really sort of open the window to that. And I can't think of necessarily ones preceding that. So there may be something I'm missing here. And you can correct me if that's the case, Andrew. But certainly the big ones are the O.J. Simpson trial.
Yeah.
And the Bill Clinton impeachment hearings.
Yeah. And the Rodney King trial as well is significant. Because especially with the history of the L.A. riots and how that ends up in many people's perspective of history. Many people hold the L.A. riots as an influencing factor on why certain things in the Simpson trial turned out as they did.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, it's suddenly that realization that the law is not something necessarily external to everyday life, but at the same time, it hybridizes with its presentation in entertainment and in fiction. So, I mean, in the course of an evening, you can go from watching cable news with, you know, Senate hearings and like depositions with star witnesses and things like that, and then kick it over to Law and Order, where half of every episode is what happens in the courtroom. And I mean, it all becomes the same continuum of consumable entertainment.
Well, yes, and it's certainly hard to ignore the fact that, yeah, particularly with the O.J. Simpson trial, many of the players became quote-unquote celebrities and became part and parcel of the entertainment industry itself in a roundabout way. Because not only do you have a star defendant in the form of O.J. Simpson, who was noted for being an entertainer and a sports player. I mean, let's
and
not
also
forget
a murderer, but go on.
Well, yes, but I was thinking
he can tweet us now.
But the point of the matter here is that, yes, on top of that, I mean, look at how many of the prosecutors and defense attorneys, you know, basically tried to parlay the exposure from this trial into becoming sort of major, you know, trying to become basically TV sort of personalities and talking
heads.
Well, yeah,
that's why I love real world people like Melvin Belli, F. Lee Bailey, Robert Shapiro, you know, cats like that, where you guys are lawyers, but you also become celebrities. And the idea of that happening in like 1900, I mean, other than like Abraham Lincoln, maybe, it's just like, that's such an interesting idea to me. But I think it's also a dangerous idea.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially in the same way that on Twitter, which Dave and I are both very active on. And you can find us on Twitter. And you can also check out our website with our full episode archive at filmstripspodcast.home.blog. There are so many memes of, like, Nancy Pelosi clapping and going, "Yes, Queen," or Robert Mueller as Superman and that. And I'm like, do we really want to be conflating superheroes with career civil servants that more often than not are working within the status quo? But, you know, it's just, it's a baffling phenomenon to me personally. And there's always something exciting and horrifying about encountering it.
Well, it's the thing. I mean, certainly I think part and parcel what this sort of led to, particularly when you start looking at 90s legal fiction, is, again, is part of that shift, that idea of the process and how the law has either been corporatized or basically corrupted through various functions, or that it's not actually living up to its the sense of justice it's supposed to deliver in the process.
Yeah, but that often comes in the form of a very binary moralist narrative where,
yes,
you know, it's taking place within the context of the law, but it ultimately comes down to your standard narrative of good and evil. There are the good lawyers, or those who stand for justice, and those who stand for money and deception.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, certainly in this day and age, I mean, it's hard to, when you, it's far more gray than that when you start getting into who gets money and where and when about these things. Certainly,
all I'm saying is Michael Avenatti gets paid first. But, like, all right, I guess the other thing is, though, and maybe why this film feels so hokey from the get-go, is there is another very, very old strain of American entertainment we could talk about, and that's basically, like, Catskills dinner theater lawyer jokes, you know? What do you call a bus full of lawyers at the bottom of the ocean? A good start. Hey, don't forget to tip your waitress.
Well, yeah.
It's, you know how they invented copper wire? Two lawyers arguing over a penny. It's just, there's something that feels like this is the natural end point of kind of that 90s fascination with legal thrillers, and that rise of, like, 90s, you know, obnoxious self-awareness. And that brings us to The Devil's Advocate. And a couple episodes ago, I was complaining about Atomic Blonde because the title made no sense. And here, the title is so literal that I can't tell if it's brilliant or the most idiotic thing in the world. It's also the kind of film that, from its title, you know exactly what this film is going to be, and you know exactly where it's going to go. And especially, like, I think what's very curious is, compare to a film like Angel Heart, which has a weirdly similar narrative when you think about it, and it has De Niro playing Satan instead of Pacino. But I mean, that's a film where there is a twist, and there is the reveal of the character's true self, and it's shocking. We don't see it coming at the first pass. Here, the entire film is predicated on the audience knowing, long before anyone else does, that Al Pacino is the devil. And that is made apparent even from watching the trailer. But yeah, so that takes us to this film. And what's weird is it comes out in 1997, but I believe the novel that it's actually based on is from the early 90s. 1990, I believe? Which is odd because this feels like that almost self-parodic end of genre cycle kind of treatment.
Well, it's a thing. So the novel it's based off of is also titled The Devil's Advocate, and yes, was published in 1990. It is by Andrew Niederman, and I will be straight up front, I haven't read the book, and honestly, I can't find a ton about it. It doesn't seem to have been, at least fairly all that popular all around. But the one thing we can note is that Niederman apparently was the one who really saw that this could potentially be a film and was basically sort of advocating it within Hollywood to try and get it adapted, with Warner Brothers picking up the rights to do it. Now, the thing was, they picked it up relatively quickly and thus began what ended up being a relatively long-ish development procedure where, yes, this film sort of passed through many, many hands before we got to its final form, including, apparently at one point, a version that would have starred Brad Pitt in the Keanu Reeves role and ended up, would have been directed by, of all people, Joel Schumacher. Whether that's a good thing or not, I really can't decide.
Well, I mean, it's not like Taylor Hackford has the greatest track record. I mean, yes,
no.
Ray did win an Oscar, and I mean, I haven't seen that movie probably since the year it came out, but I remember enjoying it. But he very much seems like a director for hire. Yeah, but Schumacher at least is distinctive, whereas I think there's something much more malleable and like conforming to what the studio wants in Taylor Hackford's style from what I've seen, because yeah. He definitely seems mercurial in how he can change with the times. Because this film, I mean, despite its narrative, aesthetically, is very, it's very different from Ray, and it's very different from White Knights. And at the same time, it feels like a very 90s film.
Well, absolutely. The key thing here is that the film spent a lot of time in development, but the reason it ended up getting going at this point in time was basically, yeah, the OJ trial sort of was seen as something that they could jump on with that.
Yeah. Gotta strike while the body's still cold.
Well, and this is one of those things where I want to make sure that we note that detail up front, because I think if this is a film that in part is now being influenced by the OJ trial and sort of an impetus for making it, it's going to be very fascinating to sort of dive into the parallels that do and don't exist with the OJ trial and what we can sort of take away from that, because there's some weird stuff going on there. The point being that Hackford comes on board. I'm assuming this is a lot comes down from his Dolores Claiborne film adaptation, which gained quite a bit of critical acclaim, and I think was a box office success around this time as well.
Yeah, I believe that one is remembered as a sleeper hit. I haven't seen the film, but I did enjoy the novel quite a bit. I thought Rob Reiner directed that. I'm more inclined to see it knowing that he didn't.
Yeah, but the, that wasn't his. But beyond that, the key thing is he does bring on another screenwriter to come in and rewrite the script. Because initially, Jonathan Linkman, behind Red Planet, and one of the 11 writers to work on Lethal Weapon 4.
11 writers? Oh, man.
You need to read Peter Bart's The Gross, which has a whole chapter dedicated to the making of that film. It is fascinating. But
all I really remember is Private Investigator. I need you to investigate my privates. And I'm like, that's funny, but it doesn't require 11 people to write.
Oh God. You know what? I'm not going to go on a tangent and take us down this road. Trust me, I'll explain Lethal Weapon 4 to you afterwards, Andrew.
Maybe that'll be our New Year's episode. You can tell me about the making of Lethal Weapon 4.
There we go.
And then I'll have a long anecdote about something in pop culture to tell you. It'll be like the gift of the Magi.
There we go. But the key thing from this is that he ends up bringing on Tony Gilroy.
Yes, who has been in theaters fairly recently with Nightcrawler.
Yes, and I believe Velvet Buzzsaw is his as well. Don't quote me on
that. Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. Did you see Nightcrawler?
Oh, God, yeah. That was honestly, I loved Nightcrawler when I seen it. I have a tremendous respect for that film. I did not see his follow-up movie, Roman Israel Esquire, if I'm not mistaken, with Denzel Washington.
I don't know. I've only seen Nightcrawler of his films, but I mean, that one, I think I can kind of see parallels. I think Nightcrawler is a much better film, but yeah. I think there's a lot of style. There's a lot of like gleeful play in the underworld and the dark side. But I think in both films, there's something where you come away from it being like, I don't think this film is actually as clever as Gilroy seems to think it is. Like there's something almost too self-assured for the tone that these films cast, because like it's much more irritating here, I think, because it's a much, much dumber film. But I mean, like, I don't know, there's something about Nightcrawler where it sort of just resolves, and kind of like your issue with Red Belt, where suddenly the film seems a lot smaller than it is.
Okay, well, I think we'll get to Nightcrawler one of these days, because I'll be intrigued to revisit it and sort of get back in, dive into that one, because I remember, like I said, loving that film, and maybe time has tempered my impression since, but we will see. But I would certainly say with Gilroy, I mean, this is somebody who's been, has a steady, long career in Hollywood at this point, and it's sort of become one of those go-to guys for working on scripts. Because let's not forget, he's also worked on the screenplay for The Bourne Identity, did do Dolores Claiborne, and also did uncredited rewrite. Well, maybe he may have been credited for the rewrites, but he also did uncredited directing work for sure on Star Wars Rogue One when that film came into its production problems as well.
I did not see that one.
You're missing nothing.
Yeah, I had a hunch on that one. The Force was telling me to save my 12 bucks.
You're wise. The key thing here, though, Gilroy is somebody who certainly has worked within the studio system a long time and basically seems to be one of those voices that, yes, Hollywood seems to at least trust enough that when his name's on there, there's a better than average chance it's probably going to get pushed through and hit in production. And from that point forward, yeah, with those two in place, there were certain plot points that were introduced late in this film that were not from the original book by all accounts, and we'll get to those later on. But that certainly changed things to some degree. And from that point, yeah, we ended up casting a Keanu Reeves coming off of the success of Speed at this point in time.
Because, I mean, there were other hits previous to that, like Point Break and things like that, and everyone's favorite Johnny Mnemonic. But, I mean, yeah, Speed, I think, is the moment that he breaks out as a young star. But that's also colliding with the old sort of dovetailing, the falling star of Al Pacino, who... in the 90s, I mean, late-stage Pacino is in full view here. And that collides with Keanu Reeves in an interesting way. And Hollywood does love pairing up the old star with the young one, like Robert Redford and Brad Pitt in Spy Game, you know? They need to do a Burt Reynolds, Ryan Reynolds team up. They missed out on that one.
Yeah, I was going to say. But the key thing here, I think the difference, though, is that one of the things we should remember is that while we're right, in hindsight, Pacino is sort of on that crest of going down in terms of his career. The key thing is he's still riding hot off of hits like Heat. And at this point in time, yeah, he's still got a number of years ahead of him of solid critical notices with things
like... I refuse to recognize Heat as a hit. That was the first movie you and I violently argued about.
I know, but what, love it or hate it, he was still a big enough success that that film was, yes, still considered him a star. The difference is, I think that's very important to note for people who are only familiar with Keanu Reeves over the past few years, is that there was a period of time, an extensive period of time, in which there was a large segment of people who hated him for no good reason because, quote unquote, he was a terrible actor and was basically the punchline for what bad acting was at that point in time.
And I mean, it's also funny because he's the same guy that ended up doing Speed, which was a huge hit, that ended up doing The Matrix, which was a huge hit, and now he's doing the John Wick films, which are huge hits. It's like the guy just calls his spots very effectively. Because it doesn't matter. People drag on him for 6 years, and then he makes more money than God and makes it look easy.
Well, not only that, but I think the other thing that people tend to forget is that Keanu Reeves, even at this point in time, whatever else you can say about him, he did not pick easy choices for the kinds of films he did. Because let's not forget, while he was doing things like Speed and the Bill and Ted films, which, again, I love them. That's not a knock on them. But this is also the guy who was going off and, oh, yeah, I'm going to appear in a Shakespearean production for Kenneth Branagh. Oh, I'm also going to go off and do My Own Private Idaho with Gus Van Sant. Oh, I'm going to go off and I'm going to do Little Buddha with for Bertolucci there. Like, he was not somebody who...
And Coppola's Dracula as well is another one. And even following this film, he does pop up here and there in just odd choices. He is the abusive husband in Sam Raimi's The Gift. He's the doctor in Thumbsucker, which is a small but amazing and I think a very self-aware kind of role.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the thing. Like, I mean, Reeves has a charisma and a charm that helps him through. Not every role is a perfect fit, and you can, to some degree, kind of understand where his quote-unquote reputation as a bad actor came from, in the sense that, you know, he took big swings and occasionally they weren't perfect fits for him. Like, don't get me wrong, I love Keanu Reeves doing Shakespeare, But you can also tell that he doesn't quite have the same rhythmic speaking patterns that sort of fit with Shakespeare's
Ophelia,
style.
Ophelia, get thee to a nunnery. Oh, I know hawk from handsaw.
But that's the thing. It's like, okay, if you're expecting, that kind of work out of reason, you're not going to get it. But yeah, when he sinks his role into a teeth into a role, he does fine work. But I think the reason we bring up the context of the night of why he was being disliked in the 90s is that, in some ways, this sort of team up with Al Pacino, it wasn't like when we see, say, Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier in Marathon Man. It's not, the up and coming, well respected star with this. Keanu Reeves was not respected at this point in time.
Yeah, he was the thin man's Rodney Dangerfield.
Oh boy. Point being here, but yeah, I mean, this is the sort of thing we're walking into this movie. I mean, I'm sure that in hindsight, a lot of people were sort of looking at it and saying, oh, it's going to be a Keanu Reeves film. It's not going to be that good. And I mean, let's be
honest.
They
were right.
Well, okay.
They were completely right. And Dave, you and I did it again. We spent half an hour talking about the film before we talked about the film.
Fair enough. So let's just get into this.
The Devil's Advocate. I mean, because, again, it's a film where I think Dave and I talk more about the issues raised by the film. Because there's not a lot there for a 2.5-hour movie. Because really it's the story of Kevin Lomax, played by Reeves.
Yes.
And he is not just a very successful trial lawyer, he has never lost a case living in Gainesville, Florida. And the film first giving us a credit scene from the 13th Warrior decides to open on a courtroom where he's defending, the dock worker guy from season 2 of The Wire by uncomfortably grilling Heather Montazaro defending a teacher accused of molesting a student.
Well, yes. And I will say this, for a big mainstream blockbuster film, that's a heck of a place to open with. I will say that. What's laid out here is the film opens, with basically the prosecution making the accusations. And it looks like this case is going terribly. What's more to the point is that Kevin notices the hand gestures as the young girl's up on the stand recounting the details of this. And he notices the hand gestures of his client,
who's rubbing the table, while looking at her with fixation.
Yeah.
But it's so over the top that, it is absolutely and explicitly clear from the get-go that the client is guilty and that Heather Montazaro is telling the truth.
Yes.
And then, Lomax has the recess where he goes to the bathroom, splashes water, looks at himself in the mirror, and then his journalist friend cracks wise about, your streak had to come to an end sometime. And then, this speaks to the film's problem in a nutshell, because we see Reeves give a pretty solid performance in his questioning, and a good performance there. But we're watching him discredit, badger, and wholly abuse the rules of questioning, discrediting a young girl and effectively gaslighting her to get her abuser off scot-free.
Well, and here's the thing. If I'm going to give the film some credit, the idea of setting up Kevin Lomax as somebody you do not necessarily like right from the get-go, that is a, for a Hollywood film, an interesting choice. And the fact that what really drives him at this point is ego. He recognizes that his client's a scumbag. And the fact that he goes through with this defense and knowingly traumatizes this young girl really, really sets us up to sort of question this guy right from the start. So on one hand, it's a deeply uncomfortable.
But here's the problem, Dave, though.
Okay.
Because I agree with that, and I think there is a case to be made for how much better this film would work if the idea that we are supposed to dislike Kevin throughout the film was actually reinforced. The problem is that Reeves, I think, is too charming in this role, where I agree with you completely. He is a charming and capable actor. He's very young and handsome here. There's something that's difficult to dislike about Kevin with his aw shucks Florida mannerisms. It's a bit hokey overall throughout the film. But I think more often than not, he's pretty affable. But that causes such a schism then when we get these scenes that, especially the way they're framed with the alternating close-ups between him and a tearful young girl talking about, have you ever played a game called Special Places? It is deeply uncomfortable. And the problem is, though, we then spend the next half of the film watching Kevin's rise, rooting for it in very positive terms. I think on his upward ascent, we are not disincentivized from rooting him on.
See?
And the film doesn't stick with him being a scumbag. And I think it would work a lot better if it did. But we soon realize, though, Kevin comes home after winning and talks to his wife, played by Charlize Theron, who, what's her character name again?
Her character name is, in this instance, Mary Ann Lomas. Yes.
Yes, Mary. Because I guess it's good that they named him Kevin and not, like, Christian Everyman or something. But that's the level of nuance this film has, though. Because very soon after this successful case, he's basically headhunted by a partner in this big New York firm on special orders from the senior partner himself, Mr. John Milton.
Well, okay, so a couple things about the scene, because let's be clear, it doesn't take place at his home. This takes place as they're dancing at a bar. And the reason I make this is because there is something that happens in this
scene.
Oh,
yeah, they all get loaded.
Yeah, and this...
A lot happens in this movie, but to me, like, a lot of this 2.5 hours doesn't matter, but go on.
Okay, no, but like I said, not to derail us on a small minutia point, but there is one thing that during the scene that, again, maybe I lived a sheltered existence. I'm going to admit that right up front here. But when a man and his wife are out at a bar and they're dancing, again, in a public place, is it very likely he will then bite his wife's clothed posterior on the dance floor? Is this really something people do, even while loaded? I question this.
Dave, you've never seen me loaded, so, you know, I got nothing to say until I'm in front of a judge.
Fair enough. Point being, anyways, yes, he is headhunted and is basically asked to come down to New York for an exorbitant amount of money for a short time to help jury selection in this trial. And the thing that's sort of noted here is that Kevin has a knack for sort of recognizing and identifying jurors that will be partial to his way of thinking and that can be manipulated by him. And from this point in time, yes, they agree they're going to take off, and they go and visit Kevin's mother here, played by, is it Judith Ivey, the actress's name? Yes, Judith Ivey.
I believe, yes.
Yeah, who, okay, and if we're going to talk about things that I don't like in this film, Judith Ivey as the most stereotypical Bible-thumping mother they can have at this point in time.
Yeah, because like they point out, she's a fundamentalist.
I'm yes.
Hitting the themes a little hard first 20 minutes.
Yes, because, and the thing is that she is a single mother. Whoever Kevin's dad was is out of the picture. This will become important and is one of those details that was not from the original book here, people. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, there might be a reason why Pacino asks about it too when he first meets
her. Yes, the key thing here that is that, yes, in this instance, you know, she's sort of, you know, after, you know, discouraged by the fact that Charlize Theron is clearly working on her day off, finally wishes her son good luck after noting that New York is basically hell on earth, more or less.
Go out as sheep among the wolves.
Yeah, yeah, and a lot more biblical quotes that are really...
Yeah, it's this film's equivalent to Christopher Nolan's, do not go gentle into that.
Thank you for bringing Michael Caine back into this. Point being, he goes to New York. He succeeds after, you know, the lawyer in charge of the trial.
Yeah, because of course they butt heads, yeah. Right? The young hotshot and the old guy being like, this kid doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't know this town. You either listen to me or I walk. And then we get that wonderful, so walk.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, who is the actor who plays the headhunter? Because I don't know if I have seen him before.
I know I've seen him somewhere. I don't think I played it. I recorded his name only because he's not in the film much in this instance. But yeah, he gives a...
Yeah, his wife kind of takes over for him.
Yeah, but he's basically there for a short bit and basically is the one who's like, yeah, welcome to the firm. He shows Kevin around and yeah, they win this trial and Kevin's about to go back. But before he does... Sure enough, the headhunter introduces him to the boss around this place, who just so happens, we should note that as Kevin's walking out of the courtroom, is mysteriously across the street near the subway entrances, spying upon them. But we see Kevin basically being given the tour of the place, where along the way to meeting John Milton.
Yes, Ruben Santiago Hudson.
Yes.
And the character's name is Heath.
Yes. But in this instance, yes, they end up going by at least one person's office, a young Connie Nielsen playing Christabella Androelli, who Kevin seems, taken with at first glance here, even though she's given one of the worst 90s haircuts I can imagine.
Oh, she's wearing like a crimson red dress, which stands out like a sore thumb. And you can tell it's a 90s film because she's wearing a headset and just pacing back and forth screaming like phrasebook Italian.
Yeah, but at this point in time, after locking eyes briefly and then her shutting her Venetian blinds, Kevin is taken over and introduced to the, rather peculiar sort of antechamber to John Milton's office, where
this looks like some kind of Satan temple.
Well, no comment. But yes, at this point in time, yes, we have Milton and Kevin discussing where, it turns out John Milton, after grilling him about his life growing up in Florida and his mother and...
No, let's rewind, though. It's like, even if you hadn't seen the trailer or the promotional materials for this film, or you somehow missed the opening credits, the moment that Al Pacino comes out in this antechamber is like, "Hi, I'm John Milton. I'm a regular person." You know, it's just like, what on earth is happening? Like, this happens about half an hour into the film. There is still another 2 hours of slow suggestions that, wait, maybe he is the devil? It's like, okay, there is a famous wrestling bit where The Undertaker, as the head of the Ministry of Darkness, kidnaps Vince McMahon's daughter Stephanie, and then 1 week, Raw ends with him like leaving her teddy bear in the ring before summoning lightning and sets it on fire. And Michael Cole on commentary hilariously yells, "The teddy bear, is this symbolic?" And I feel like I was watching this film, and every time something happened, all I could picture is like, he doesn't have a bed. Is this symbolic? His name is John Milton. Is this symbolic? He can quote the Bible. Is this symbolic? He can stick his hand in a vat of holy water and make it bubble during a funeral while smirking up at a picture of angels. Is this symbolic, David? Why is this happening?
We're going to get to that scene later on. Trust me, Hits and Pits is coming. But the key thing here is, A, this is a perfect time to mention that hashtag WWE Professional Wrestling in the Digital Age, edited by Drew Jeffries, is now available in stores and includes at least one essay co-written by Dr. Jeffries and our very own Andrew Kanagizer. Please order your copy today.
No, I just did copy it.
Supposedly.
Wrestling's fake anyway.
Here's the thing, Andrew, and I will say this flat out here. You are absolutely right about everything you've just said. And while I'm saying that, I absolutely do not care, because literally, this is the level of film we're dealing with, number one, yes, the trailers and every piece of the advertising for this film spoiled the idea that John Milton is the devil right from the get-go. So, unless you had somehow missed everything coming into this movie in terms of a marketing campaign, you knew that who Al Pacino was playing right off the bat. So, it's not like they are trying to hide it. And the thing about...
But as far as Kevin goes, the film ultimately kind of climaxes with Kevin finally piecing that and something else together, and to him, it's a big twisting reveal. Whereas we've spent the last 2 hours and 15 minutes in a state of dramatic irony in a very stupid film.
See, here's the thing, though. I don't think that that's what they are intending to play up as the twist. For Kevin, it's a shock, but I don't think for 1 minute that's what we're supposed to take as the twist there for the audience's perspective. It's about
You mean the fact that the real twist, yes, is that Milton ends up being Kevin's father.
Yes, and that's the thing, I think, where this film still overplays its hand, and you can figure this out from like minute one when you're watching this.
Yeah, because the very first conversation is, "Tell me about your mother."
Yes.
And like,
Or, tell me about your father. I never knew my dad. Oh, so your mother never remarried?
Well,
my mother was never married. Huh. I bet you're wondering why I'm asking you this.
Well,
hola.
Here's the thing. Again, you're absolutely right. But I will say this about this movie. Al Pacino is hamming it up to such a degree with such glee in his eye. I just don't care.
Yeah, there is no scene where he doesn't just start laughing at something he says himself for no real reason. And it is kind of delightful. I feel like I would have liked this movie a lot more if I watched it with you.
But this is the thing I find about it. It's like, this film is so over the top, and Al Pacino is just going so for broke, and Keanu Reeves is so earnest in his performance, that this film ends up being this sort of giddily, enjoyably bad movie as I watch it. It's like, yeah, this is dumb as a rock. Yeah, and there are plot points that will literally make no sense and make the mythology of the Omen films look comprehensible by comparison. And I hate the Omen series, folks. Let's make that clear. This is just, like, fascinatingly bad right from the start. But it's the kind of bad that you could...
But I'm also going to stop you there, David, because I agree with you that I think that would be another angle this film could take, where it goes that extra level of absurdity. And the gag of the film is that, how can Kevin not realize what's going on and he's the only person who doesn't? Like, that could be funny. But the problem is that these scenes are counterbalanced by Mary's arc, which I think is very problematic and very uncomfortable, because there is nothing about them. Like, basically, she exists in this film for bad things to happen to be driven mad, to be gaslit, victimized, sexually and physically assaulted, and then end up killing herself. Like, we are watching, concurrent with this, a woman's slow decline as a result of multiple abusers in her life, and that's not helped by the fact that women in this film really are treated as an object to be possessed or looked at.
Yes.
And that really makes it difficult for me to enjoy this film or take it as goofy cinema, I guess. Because there's a lot about the Mary scenes that really come off as like the theater of cruelty.
Oh, yeah, and you're not wrong. And let me be clear about this. I am not saying that this film is without some serious problematic elements. Almost all of it revolving around Mary. There's some other stuff we'll get into once we get into the Cullen side of things as well that... I'll be interested to get your opinions on some things, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah. The thing is, Mary is the only actress in the film who has the benefit of receiving a character. And so when the only woman on screen that's actually fleshed out beyond the level of like plot device or mise-en-scène, literally we are just watching her suffer and then eventually become physically broken down. There could be something to it in more capable hands. That's not saying all films have to be optimistic. There's certainly something to be said for tragedy, but it doesn't work as it's deployed in this film.
Well, what this film is basically doing is it's sort of a riff on the Rosemary's Baby plotline, but with the exception that she's not supposed to bear the child. Keep that in mind. That'll be important. But effectively, yeah.
And not just because she was in the astronaut's wife.
Yeah, but the key thing here is that effectively what she's getting is that treatment throughout this film. The difference is imagine if John Cassavetes' husband character in that film was dumb and not in on the Satanist plan from the get-go. That's kind of what we're seeing here with Keanu Reeves's Kevin Lomax. So yeah, to get into this film a little bit further in the plot, effectively what happens is, yes, Kevin's offered basically to head up the criminal trial part of this large, omnipresent firm.
Yeah, they do a bit of everything. Business as far away as Burundi.
Yes, so yeah, there's international law, there's all sorts of stuff, and of course, yes, we have Eddie Barzun basically heading up the firm in Milton's absence, played by, yes, scumbag Jeffrey Jones.
Yeah, record-setting actor and record-possessing actor Jeffrey Jones. What is Google? So he's the stuffed shirt that kind of is set up as like the minor antagonist for Kevin.
Yeah,
because there comes up this weird little mystery, because a number of smaller narratives form over the film, and one like late at night, Kevin's burning the midnight oil, and then he comes across Barzun and his team feverishly shredding documents.
Yeah.
And talking cryptically about a man named Weaver.
Yeah, because basically the thing about Barzun is he's basically a white-collar criminal. He's behind some sort of shenanigans, likely with corporate clients, and basically Weaver is a U.S. prosecutor. Yeah, that is more or less investigating them.
Yeah, and later in the film when we meet Weaver, it certainly implied, like, they're doing, like, money laundering and, like, international arms deal. They're basically being legal cover for black market operations.
Yeah, but the point is that, yes, Kevin's brought in to sort of head up this criminal defense team side of things, and yeah.
And I will say, I do like that boardroom scene and the joke where they go around the table and there's, like, 30 different people, and it's just, so-and-so, maritime law. So-and-so, mergers and acquisitions. So-and-so, Italian commodities.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, yeah.
Now you know the whole family. Oh,
yeah. The key thing is that in addition to this, it turns out that, you know, Milton not only has his employees working for him, but for the sort of creme de la creme, the top there, he also owns a building where basically these large extravagant apartments are for his major players at his corporate firm, with him living in the tower itself. And yes, Kevin and Marianne move in here, and after sort of the scene where they start realizing, it's, oh, look how much space we have. We can actually have time to have a baby, because that's Marianne's big thing. She wants to have a child.
Oh, yeah. I mean, your life is meaningless if you don't.
Well, okay, let's be clear. I don't think there's, if you want to have a child, there's no reason, there's no shame in her wanting to have it. It's just the fact that, yes, in the grand scheme of this film, what we end up seeing with Mary is that she goes from somebody who's working on a Sunday and getting glares from Kevin's mother to just giving up any prospects of having a job and doing nothing else with her time. And
because, like, at first she talks about how, like, she repossesses cars and stuff, and it's like, hey, that's a cool affectation. And the second that she gets to New York, it's like, can't do anything, I don't want to do anything. And it's like, well,
why? Yeah.
There's no rule that says you have to sit in the apartment all day. But, like, I think that just speaks to the film framing, like, the ultimate desire she has deep down. Like, her problem and the growing separation between her and Kevin as he spends more and more time with the firm and caught up in the job is that he grows distant. But the reason that's framed as a problem in the narrative is that because the one thing she wants more than anything is a child.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there are certainly worse examples of this trope being deployed. But again, it's reducing women in this film to objects of temptation or objects of procreation. Like, this film literally presents women along a hard Madonna whore complex divide.
No, you're absolutely completely correct.
And her name is Mary. Come on. Is this symbolic?
Well, again, you know, at this point, why wasn't Kevin called Joe Lomax? I mean, I'm just saying, you're already halfway there. Take it the full way here, movie.
Exactly. Or just do what they did in End of Days and name him Jericho Kane.
That's a film I'm looking forward to getting to one of these days.
And two of my favorite wrestlers.
There we go. But in this instance, what ends up happening is, yes, they move in. She's going to be in charge of sort of decorating the apartment, which leads to, while Kevin's off working, which leads to a rather weird sort of montage.
Yeah, a montage that comes from a completely different film.
Yeah, with her, yeah, with basically her painting walls, which ends up acting as the wipe to sort of move on to the next scene.
Such a bizarre transition, yeah, for a film of this nature.
Yeah, and so basically Kevin gets what he thinks is a case just to sort of test him and basically see whether he'll pursue what's presumably going to be a loser case. And in this instance, who happens to be? Well, Delroy Lindo popping up as Felipe Moyes is basically committing what appears to be ritual sacrifices of animals.
Yeah, I think he's presented as like sort of a Haitian, almost like a Houndoun type figure. That he does these sacrifices, but there's a bit of the old voodoo.
Yes, and the key thing is he's been arrested by the NYPD, and it looks like this case is going to go down for acts of animal cruelty and other things. And Kevin takes on the case and then turns things around after investigating the sort of New York law and turns it into a religious rights issue where he is being denied.
Yeah, it's that same stupid argument you get from people who, like, you know, first word in their bio is atheist.
Yeah.
Where it's like they think being like, did you ever think about this contradiction in the Bible? That they think that's going to convert everybody.
Yeah.
But I digress there. Yeah. But he makes the argument. He's like, sure, Mr. Moyes has some crazy ideas. They're not as normal as circumcision.
Well, okay.
Which is a valid point.
Yeah. Now, which is a valid point. And to be fair, I think you're overplaying Reeves's Southern or Floridian accent a little bit here.
Yuck.
Yeah, he is not local.
Hey, everybody.
He is not
Satan's
the local.
My dad.
Oh, God. Yes, the, he is not.
I'm very sorry to everyone.
Apparently. Point of the matter is that, yes, Kevin ends up winning this case. And we see that there's a bit of, you know, the tension that's coming home with Kevin's not always being read.
Oh, yeah. We forgot to mention that Moyes also puts nails through a goat's tongue. So the prosecutor can't speak and object to the ridiculous argument.
Yeah. Yeah. That may be important later. Point being here is, you know, following a party where, yes, we see Kevin and Christabella out in the way, and Kevin's wife, Marianne, getting really frustrated when Kevin gets called upstairs and leaves her sort of isolated at a party, which, again, this is sort of the weird thing with Marianne, where her character keeps shifting to based upon the needs of the scene, because early on, she seems like a sort of carefree and wild, and she loves work and everything, and then she becomes more sort of docile and insecure and more needy in a way that doesn't match what we see earlier in the film. It's a weird character.
Well, she even says in the film that she had a panic attack, and that, I mean, it is different than her character at the beginning of the film. I think it also just underscores that throughout the film, it's 2.5 hours of watching a woman become solely dependent on her husband for everything.
Yeah, which, again, I think if it would be better if, better writing and more time is dedicated to establishing just what her character is.
Or, like,
is.
You could even make something of that, but this film just presents it and doesn't do anything. And I think you're very correct in that it's sort of a scene-by-scene characterization.
Yeah.
But the reason the boys are upstairs, there's a big new case that's come in, and it turns out that hotshot real estate developer Craig T. Nelson,
yeah.
I mean Alex Cullen, has been arrested under allegations of murdering his wife, his son, and the babysitter?
And basically, yeah, he's murdered his family, or he's been accused of murdering his family. He was found there, prints are in the blood, his hands were on the weapon, and yes. Now, here's where I think things get interesting, because...
because it's like a 40-minute mini-movie in the context of the main one?
Well, for a couple reasons, because here's the thing. Let's come back to the idea that this was a film where the reason Warner Brothers really wanted to get this thing made was to play off of the celebrity trial of O.J. Simpson. At this point in time,
yes,
we have a film where effectively Kevin is handed a high profile celebrity case with this Alex Cullen. Now, I think this is interesting for a couple of reasons, because the thing that this film does, and it's probably for the best because I could see exactly how they would screw it up right here.
Is that the defendant is a white person?
Yes.
And a white male and an older one at that?
Yes, because, yeah, they basically try to, you know, sort of separate the idea of the racial dynamics of the OJ trial from the celebrity aspect of it and play up the sort of spectacle that came with the trial by playing out with the Alex Cullen stuff. The big point here is that, yes, this film basically, yeah, just takes that off of the equation and instead gives us Cullen, who by all accounts is basically Donald Trump from here.
Yeah.
He is a real estate developer, a wealthy New Yorker, and by all accounts, a pure scumbag who happens to have a gilded gold apartment when they go inside there. And it's like, yeah, I mean, boy, this, you know, was sort of predicting where things would go with this. But I think this is the case where, again, you can kind of see where this is where I think, yeah, the film becomes a little more on rails and a little more focused, where we do see that as Marianne's sort of psychological state is deteriorating as she's sort of haunted by the specters of something that's going on throughout.
Yeah, because it's not just separation from Kevin. After a point, she's actively being tormented by monsters.
Yes, and in this instance, yes, we have this whole case with Cullen. And again, I find it fascinating where this, again, to sort of indicate where the legal thriller here is, this is more about public relations and manipulating the system mm-hmm. in order to go through. And I think if the film does have some cleverness here, it's the fact that, yeah, it's recognizing that Kevin is basically playing the game, playing games through the media and with those around him in order to get Cullen off throughout it. Now, and again, if you want to get into the sort of metatextual side, again, this ends up being where Kevin ends up almost acting like both actor and director at the same time, particularly as he starts coaching his witnesses for this case, particularly being the big one being what turns out to be, quote-unquote, B, Cullen's lover, who he was actually with, quote-unquote, at the time of the murder, even though, as we'll end up finding out, that wasn't actually the case, and it's all a big cover story in the grand scheme of things.
Okay, but I know I said I would be quiet, but I think that's a big problem the way this mini-narrative results, because the scene where Pacino announces that that was Alex Cullen, he's murdered his family, like, they talk about it, and it seems like they proceed on the assumption that Cullen most likely did it. And even in the scenes between Reeves and Cullen, which, you know, I think are pretty effective in terms of Reeves showing himself as an actor and being, as you said, that director-type role, there almost seems to be this sense of, like, I think you did it, but here's, we need to get your story straight for your benefit. When he finally finds out, though, that the alibi is fake, though, that prompts this moment of crisis in ways that I don't think entirely make sense. Because it's like, so what, you actually thought he was innocent this whole time? You thought everybody was being honest this whole time? But if that upsets you, why does that upset you? Because it's pretty clear in the opening scene that his client is guilty, and furthermore, the confrontation after the verdict is said, Reeves knows that his client is guilty. So he's not doing anything that he didn't do before.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's meant to be a thematic callback to the initial trial scene in terms of him once again making a choice based upon ego and his desire to succeed versus any morals and ethics that he may hold there.
Oh, yeah, because along the way, Milton keeps riding the subway with him and having philosophical discussions about, like,
well, why do you think you need to win so badly? Let this one go. Go be with your wife. And you're right, Kevin keeps pointing out,
no, I've got to see this one through.
Well, yes. Jesus Christ. He's not, you know, Huckleberry Hound.
I know, he's far better than that, but now that I've started doing it, I can't.
Fair enough. The key thing, but you're absolutely right, and I think you're not wrong. I think what really, what gets me about the film is what it tends overlooks, and I think this is bothers me even more so, is I can see the idea of Kevin being somebody with enough of a conscience to recognize that he's doing wrong while at the same time still being ego-driven enough to still go ahead and do the wrong thing. I'm okay with that. What gets me about the film is that there is the big crux of defendants having legal representation in cases as well. And at no point in time does anybody give voice to the fact that, yes, his clients may be scumbags, but as the system set up, they are still entitled to a defense.
Yeah, right to counsel matters, just like Miranda rights matter.
Yeah.
You know, the hard thing about principles and why I hate the popularization of the law as entertainment is that it's very easy to lose sight of the fact that the rights we advocate for, it's important to continue advocating for them, even when people we disagree with benefit from them.
Well, and this is the tricky thing. The film sort of sidesteps that issue altogether, and particularly when we get to the closing scenes, does so in a way that I think is deeply problematic and really just sort of sweeps that all aside in a way that is not satisfying at all. But I think that's sort of where I fall on. I'm more okay, comfortable with where Kevin as a character is coming from these things. We should also note that there is an additional scene that we sort of skipped where that's going to be important later on, where yes, Kevin sort of promises Marianne that yes, they will have a child, which leads to a scene of coitus, since that's now going to be my go-to word for these purposes. That is...
The old whoopee.
Yes, what is an...
And I don't mean Miss Goldberg. Yeah, it's a... this scene, I think it's worth talking about.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on here.
Well, okay, I see what the scene is attempting to do, because basically what we have is the whole idea of Kevin and his wife, you know, becoming attracted, or, you know, and getting down to the nitty-gritty of the scene. And as this is... Bear with me here, folks. I prefer euphemisms in this instance. As you can tell, I may be not the most comfortable individual when it comes to discussing these subjects. But the key thing is, as this is going on, Kevin starts seeing his wife as Christabella. Now, as this is going on, I mean, the attempted theory of what the scene is supposedly going for is that Kevin is somehow being distant and being weird with his wife at this point, and she's noticing it.
Well, he's being aggressive, and I mean, I think there is that effective sort of the montage where, as he's thrusting upwards, his arm keeps passing by the camera, and every time it alternates between Christabella really enjoying it and then Mary getting more distressed. And I think, again, it's that idea of, do you want romantic love with your wife and starting a family, or do you want to take a walk on the wild side?
Well, and it's, I see what they're going for. It's just the staging of how it's done that's really weird, because even moments like when she starts talking about, like, what are you doing? This is at a moment where, I kid you not, Charlize Theron's, I'm assuming it's her feet, are in Keanu Reeves' mouth at this point in time.
Yes.
And it's moments like that where it's like, okay, I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt to assume that maybe that's a weird thing that's going on between you two. I don't know what your previous liaisons have been like, but I am just going to say that, I mean, it's those sort of interjections at points where it's like, it's not clear necessarily that he's being aggressive per se. It's like he's being a distant, and it's like...
I mean, it always helps to get permission first, but yeah, it doesn't quite accord. I get, like, there's nothing inherently, like, taboo about kissing bubbles.
Well,
in the same way that, I don't mean to say.
Yeah, but I think but this comes back to, again, my point about the bar scene earlier, and when they're loaded and Reeves.
Oh, yeah. Thing,
where it's like,
good point.
Where it's like, okay, there seems to be a disconnect between the behavior of that earlier scene and them in here. And again, if there's a shift in her character.
Well, because at first it needs to show they're happy, and now it needs to show that they're distant. So.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like Kevin changes through the film, so she needs to change around him to enable that as an heir.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's just such a weird dynamic here, and...
But it also speaks to something in the film where a lot of it visually is very standardized and looks very firmly within that sort of, like, Dimension Lionsgate kind of film style.
Yeah.
That high gloss look to it, but... Every now and then there are just very odd formal choices that seem like they're trying to get too cute or going outside of what they can do. Like, there's, you know, some very odd transitions. We get a couple just very curiously placed time-lapse transition shots of night to day. We get an odd shot of Mary looking off screen while laying horizontal, doing an eyeline match of then... A skyscraper building that's rotated 90 degrees perpendicular and then rotates down as the transition. And it's like, why are these things happening? It feels like they belong in a different movie because the rest of the movie seems so
interesting. Well, I can tell you exactly what they're doing in the movie. Taylor Hackford was basically auditioning to direct Daredevil. He saw the writing on the wall and decided that, no, I'm going to out Mark Steven Johnson. And, well, you gotta say, he tried. But,
Well, I mean, this film also ties in with Sin City, now that I think about it, because that famously had a scene guest directed by Quentin Tarantino. The scene of Keanu Reeves putting her foot in his bath. Never mind.
Jesus. Anyways, moving on. The key thing is, weird scenes of coitus aside in terms of, you know, not what's being presented, but so much just what we're supposed to take away from it. The key thing here is... Basically, yeah, as Mary's mental state continues to deteriorate, we have a visit with Kevin's mother during this where, yes, she comes to this apartment, and in the quote-unquote chance meeting with John Milton and Christabella and random assorted individual who happens to be with them.
Isn't it Heath's wife?
I don't think it is. I think it's a different character altogether, but I mean, the point being that...
Oh, right. This is Sophie. Just came in from Paris.
Yeah.
Va-va-voom.
Yeah. The key thing is that, yes, there's a sequence where he asks Mrs. Lomax, Kevin's mother, oh, is this your first time in New York? And of course, she's sort of silent and quiet, and Kevin just jumps in. It's like, yes, yes, it is.
No, she's more than silent and quiet. She is giving every possible body language signal of, I know this man, and I'm afraid of him.
Yes, that is true. And after they get off the elevator, a couple of key things happen. Basically, A, Kevin turns around and sees, for some reason, Christabella and Sophie making out. There is temptation because just Al Pacino grinning like a goofball up in the right it's just, again, it's those little moments where it's just, it's hard not to.
You ever seen two pretty ladies kiss in an elevator?
It's like just everything about Milton, like the fact that they go out to a Mexican restaurant and alternate between dancing to the floor to him, like, looking around and smiling at everybody as another woman kneels under the table. It's just, there's a level of garishness that becomes just ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
And not in a fun, cartoony way. It's just like,
look, I could dispose of human bodies at my very whim. It's okay when they're famous, they let you do it. You know, it's just,
even if you're critiquing that or it's meant to be absurd, like, that draws on too many real world things that are done by people in positions of power to be that enjoyable after a point.
I think it's more the fact that it's Al Pacino going for broke, and it's just like, this is so patently silly in terms of just how, blatantly obvious everything about him being the devil is, and how everybody doesn't even correspond to human behavior for the most part in terms of everybody else at the firm.
And Kevin's continued obliviousness.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it.
He can't be the devil. He lives at the top of the building. The devil would live in the basement.
Jesus. At any rate, Sergeant Gomer Pyle aside, what ends up happening is, yes.
Oh, don't forget that Eddie gets murdered by vagrants.
Well, I was getting there. Yes. Basically, Kevin's mother decides, I'm not sticking around here. I have to leave. Eddie Barzun is killed, after being his daily jog by vagrants, which may or may not be witnessed by Mary Ann, I'm still not sure.
No, it is, of all the windows of all times of day to look out,
Yeah.
It's just further proof that it's not just, like, after a point, especially as the demons start appearing, it's not just that Kevin's growing cold to her and she's being isolated. It's that, like, for reasons, Milton is actively trying to torment
her. We'll get there, folks. But yes, the key thing...
Well, we need to get there, because I need to stop talking about this movie before I disassociate completely.
Fair point. Key point being that...
And also then we meet Weaver, who then spills the beans that it's an evil law firm, and then he dies. And just, there's a lot of little plots that happen and string this film out far longer than it needs to be strung.
Yeah, and I will give you that. The key thing here is that basically, yes, finally, Marianne, after talking about how she's seeing monsters and other things actively haunting her, Kevin basically does, he decides, I'm going to be a loving husband and look after her. And, he decides to put her away in an asylum.
Yeah. And this coincides with the end of the Cullen trial.
Right? Yeah, and...
Because the tipping point is she's covered in scratches and says that Milton came over and basically sexually assaulted her.
Yeah.
And Kevin's like, that's impossible. He was in the courtroom with me all day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he throws her in the institution.
Yes.
Where, turns out, Pam is also a monster and convinces her to freak out, break a mirror, and then cut her own throat. While everyone watches as a civilian smashes a door down and shoves aside security staff in a mental hospital.
Yeah. While we should also note that Kevin's mother, having fled New York, has returned at this point and is there trying to reveal something to Kevin, which she can't quite do before Marianne, kills herself.
Exactly. I have something very important to tell you. What is it, Mom? It is so important. I should have told you sooner. I really, really should have told you sooner.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that I didn't tell you my secret when I had the chance. But now I absolutely... What's that noise?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's...
It's one of those scenes, and it's all like, ugh.
Yeah.
You can say a lot in a letter.
Well, this is... Yeah, absolutely. The key thing is, following Marianne's suicide and Kevin packing up all his wife's things there and carrying him out, he finally tells his mother, he's like, what were you telling me? Get it out. And she basically says that, yes, John Milton was the man who... At first, sweet-talked her back when she went visiting the big city in New York back in her youth. And that, yes, from the way she recounts it, sexually assaulted her, which resulted in the birth of Kevin himself. And at this point in time, Kevin starts leaving the building to go see his father, where New York is now magically deserted.
Which is kind of a striking scene to encounter. Because, like, the rest of the film, like, it's... The paranormal elements have been very localized. And here, you know, it's an intense scene, and then he just steps out, and yeah, the streets are completely deserted.
Yeah.
I mean, that does, it hits you in an unexpected way, and one of the few times this film does that pleasantly.
We'll get into some questions about the devil's abilities and what's going on here, but we'll get there in a moment.
Of course.
But the key thing here is that, yes, Kevin makes his way back to the apartment building, heads up to the tower to Milton, where to Milton's room, where he gets up there.
Oh, and he also has Chekhov, or in this case, Alexander Cullen's handgun.
Yes, because he demanded it from Cullen to him until the trial was done.
Yeah, 90 minutes in the film earlier. Good thing he didn't change clothes.
Yes, the key thing being that he gets up there, and Milton, in this instance, basically starts pointing out to him that it's like, yes, I'm your dad. Also, I'm the devil, if you haven't put that together yet. And starts going on into this gloriously absurd monologue with Al Pacino eating every single line of it.
Yeah, and being lit by firelight. So, just in case it wasn't clear, he also looks red for most of it.
Yes.
But, I mean, like, the only thing it was missing would be, like, you know, Kevin walking in and then jumping like, pleased to meet you. Hope you guess my name.
Yeah. What he needed, you know, was like, the horns on the head.
But then it's like, yeah. Who am I? And then Kevin just stares like, Satan. Call me dad.
Yeah. It's, and that's the sort of stuff where it's like, yeah, this is the film going full bonkers territory. And I'm all
for
it. Yeah.
But then it plays out for like a good 15 minutes of this.
Yeah. And, but that's the basic details that we need to know is, along with the absentee landlord monologue that, Miller, that Pacino gets to deliver here.
God says, look, but don't touch. He's laughing at you.
Yeah. What ends up happening is that, yes, Christabella walks in a robe, and basically Milton points out to her that not only are you my son, this is my, you know, half-sister here as well. And yes, she proceeds to disrobe for Connie, so that everybody can see Connie Nielsen fully nude, because...
Oh, natural. Yes. Yeah. It's, because, I mean, I feel like the screenwriters didn't have faith in the dialogue carrying this scene.
Yeah, but the thing that's important to note here is that what Milton points out is basically... What has everything been about in this entire time?
Yeah, what's the plan here, Dave?
Yeah, now this is stuff that was apparently not from the novel. This is all was invented for the film. Not only is Kevin the Satan's son, what his basically he wants to have happen is that, yes, he wants Kevin to actually take over the firm, along with his half-sister. He also wants them to copulate in order to produce a child, because the millennium's coming here, folks, and the big dookaroo is going to happen between God and Satan in this instance, and he needs, you know,
holy cow!
Yeah, and he needs to have basically what Kevin refers to as the Antichrist, as I guess his weapon in this. Now,
to be fair, he says more like Antichrist.
All right, but the key thing here that's important to note is this is where all sorts of questions start asking. Number one, let's start with the M. Bison question. If Kevin was so important to you, why did you lose him in the first place? Wouldn't this whole plan have been so much simpler if you just took the boy and raised him? That seems well within your power.
No. The film actually does explain that, Dave.
Okay, fill me in.
And this is probably the one time I will defend this movie, because so much of that final monologue is about free will. And the whole idea is that it wouldn't have mattered if he had forced Kevin to do any of it. It's that Kevin had to choose to enter into that, because that's where we realize that everything, and quite rightly, Milton points out that every bad thing that led to this point was the result of Kevin choosing, like, basically refusing to accept a loss, refusing to accept that there are things he cannot do, refusing to, to be defeated. And so the whole thing is, you know, because he has that line, especially when we get Connie Nielsen laid out, like, so much of the object of the gaze, and Pacino's like, well, it's free will, you gotta do it. And he's like, well, it's not much of a choice. And he's like, well, free will's a curse word.
Yeah. But here's the thing.
It's that idea, though, where it's like, it has to be a voluntary act. I guess you can set up circumstances so it's coerced to the greatest degree possible, but they need to choose it. Because magic.
Okay, they need to choose it, but that doesn't explain why he couldn't raise the boy in the first place. It's not like, you know, because clearly he can raise his daughter to go ahead and do all these things. I mean,
because God raised his kids and he's rebelling again. Okay.
Yeah, that's where my problem.
You convinced me. I hate this movie again. Good.
But I mean, that's the thing it throws me. It's like, okay, so basically this is the M. Bison plan of, I lost this kid that was really important to me, despite the fact that I have all this power to be able to accomplish this. Why did I make this so difficult for myself? Putting that aside for the second. The other thing that makes no sense to me about this is, okay, why? Maybe I'm bringing too much quote unquote realism to the movie for this point. And
are you thinking in terms of genetic lineage the same way I am?
I think so, because the thing about it is,
like, if you're both half Satan, wouldn't your child only be like a quarter Satan?
Exactly. So like,
why is that the Antichrist and not Kevin or Christabel?
Well, exactly. And I mean, if they're required to, you know, engage in coitus in order to create this Antichrist, we'll put that in quotes for a second here. I mean, okay, is it because it's an act of incest? Because if that's the case, I mean, it's already icky to start with in so many ways, but that just adds a whole nother layer of weirdness to this whole thing, in which
case, well, maybe it's the inversion of purity. But I mean, like, if he needs full demons, like, he also has demons in his employ, because we realize that not only can he create illusions, but that, like, Heath's wife, for instance, is a monster. Pam is a monster, you know? But, like, that also begs the question of, like, so does everyone who works for the law firm, are they aware that Milton is Satan? Are they agreeing to go along with that? Is it an open secret? Is the guy in the mailroom like, yes, hail Lord Milton, you know? Like, how deep does this go? Because, you know, Eddie clearly seems to know something is up with Milton, right?
To a point.
And, like, yeah. Heath clearly knows that there's something up, you know? So it's like, what do they know? Like, it's like in Rosemary's Baby, where it turns out everyone's a Satanist.
Yeah. But, I mean, at least in that case, there is clearly a cult doing this, and everyone's in on it. This film never tells us. But more to the point, here's the other big difference here. In the case of Rosemary's Baby, not that I like to defend Polanski movies, as you all are well aware of. The thing about it is, it's pretty clear the cult is around to help lead to the creation of that child. For whatever reason, yes, you know, as nebulous as we understand the metaphysics of the universe, for some reason, this is required. He needs the assistance of these people to lead to the creation of this. All right, even if we assume, let's just say I give this film the idea that somehow the devil has to have two children who then will have coitus with one another in order to create this other child, which will then be the Antichrist. Let's just say I give
I'm with you. Here. All right, go on.
Here's what I'm still not entirely sure on. What is the point of Milton owning a legal firm and doing any of this? Why does he need
to? Well, because he says law is everywhere. It's bigger than the clergy. But
what does that mean? Like, you...
I don't know. Like, because lawyers are evil, they can hide in plain sight.
I mean, it's like, I'm going along with this because it's like, this is clearly dumb as a rock, and Al Pacino's still having fun playing it, so I'm eating it up. Yeah. But it's, at the same time, this is beyond stupid, because it's like, you have the power.
We're also on retainer. If we bring about Armageddon, we also get our disbursements paid for.
But that's exactly, it's like, okay, so either, I mean, is this just like the side hustle to keep yourselves busy? It's like, I've already got my army all set to go here. So, you know what? I wanted a hobby. I needed to keep busy.
Or is it like the implicit joke about, like, how can my children be anything other than lawyers? Don't forget to tip your wages.
Well, exactly. Like, nothing about this makes sense. The only thing, I mean, and not to mention, I'd just like to know, I hope to God that basically Al Pacino was calling Bob De Niro from the set and just kept joking about it. It's like, huh, did you get to do this? Did you get to go this big? I don't think you got to do it in Angel Heart. That's right. That's right. I'm going to stick my pinky into water and it's going to cause some crazy stuff to happen. I mean, like, this is...
Who's the best actor now? Spoiler, it's me.
But that's what I mean. Like, putting this aside, basically, for whatever reason, Kevin looks like he's going to engage in these acts, but instead decides, free will, takes out the gun, shoots himself in the head.
Which causes the fresco on the wall to mutate and catch on fire. It causes Pacino to lose his shirt.
And go and catch up.
And it causes Christabella to basically turn into stone.
And on top of that, yes, let's not forget that all of a sudden, Milton then morphs into his angel form that is like half...
But he, like, also kind of turns into Kevin.
Yeah, where it's like, yeah. This is...
What does that even mean?
It's because it's like, well, if he's, you know, if he's an angel and his true form is supposed to be angelic, that clearly can't be Al Pacino there. I mean, Keanu Reeves is more baby-faced than that, so I guess. But at any rate, it's like, this is all bonkers, and you would think that, okay, maybe... This is where you might think the film would end, and it's like, it's a downbeat note, and everything's done, and for some reason...
we stop the devil, and man will live to fight another millennium.
Yeah, but that's not what happens, is it, Andrew?
No, we get a tunnel of flaming bodies, and, like, you know, the unused CG renders from the movie Spawn, and suddenly we're flashed back to the very first time that Kevin went to the bathroom, all the way back to the beginning of the film, while he is about to deliver his address to the jury for, you know, Mr. Guy from The Wire. And instead, he walks back in the courtroom, he sees Mary with her curly hair, and, like, they kiss, and,
I missed you, babe. Feels like it's been forever. Yeah. You're looking mighty pretty.
This is like the worst goofy then, short ever.
Yeah. And then, he's about to give his defense, and then he says that he can't. He requests to be taken off the case. He does the right thing. Everyone freaks out. You'll be disbarred for this. You'll never work in this town again, Lomax. But then as he's leaving, like, he just explains to, Mary that he did the right thing. And as he's leaving, his reporter friend, who is needling him about losing the case, he is being like, well, no, this is big. They might disbar you, but people want to hear about, like, a lawyer doing the right thing. I want to do a story on you. And he hems and haws, and Ken's like, all right, call me first thing in the morning. I got a new rotary in. It was a gift from my grandkid. And then him and Mary look off, and then the journalist looks down the staircase, and then he looks directly at the camera while his face morphs into Al Pacino, and what does he say?
Vanity, my favorite sin.
Here's what the thing is, I wish, for anybody who's seen the earlier cuts of Heat before this was deleted from the recent director's version, Al Pacino has a line, which is still in the trailer for Heat, I might add, that you can see, where he all of a sudden delivers the Bugs Bunny line, ain't I a stinker? I wish the film had closed out on that.
My God.
That would have been
incredible. Yeah. I also think I would like Heat more if at the end, like, Hannah, after Macaulay's dead, like, Hannah walks back in the car, looks in his rear view mirror, and then his face turns to Robert De Niro.
Oh, God. Anyways.
But he turns to the camera and says, well, I got nipples, Faka. Can you milk me?
Okay, then. What ends up happening is...
The show is brought to you by Robaxacet Platinum. So that's the second movie in a row, though, David, that ends with a character looking directly at the audience.
This was not planned, and yes, you are quite right. And then this naturally chooses to go out on a more subtle note, however, of having Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Red Right Hand, play. Oh, no, I'm sorry, they went for the obvious choice of... The Rolling Stones, Sympathy for the Devil, because...
Painted Black.
Oh, you're right. Oh, God, okay, I just broke...
David!
That's gonna get edited.
Oh, man. Like, 90 episodes to get our first bleep, and it wasn't even me. I'm so proud of you. Yes, we get Painted Black, that wonderful song. Satan, and, well, also a callback to Mary's character. Maybe she should have painted it black. Then we miss out on that wonderful slide light. So there's a lot going on in this movie, and I think it's safe to say that there are things that you can enjoy about this film, but it's very difficult to reconcile as a whole, because most of the goofy and silly things are kind of balanced and weighed out equally or even dragged down by the more problematic and sort of grounded elements in this story being told. You think that's a fair summation?
It's a fair summation, and yeah, your mileage will vary in terms of how much you're willing just to go with those goofy elements. In many ways, this is kind of a perfect encapsulation of big studio horror filmmaking from the 90s in terms of, we're going to make a serious horror movie with serious Al Pacino and, you know, big name stars.
Why is Al Pacino the producer?
But the key, I don't know why, but the point here is that, look, at this point, it's any excuse for a Pacino impression, but I mean, this is the thing where it's like, this movie, it's a dumb mainstream movie, but it's also dumb.
Yes, it is.
It is the.
But I think it's also a film that thinks it's very clever.
But that's the same thing. It falls into the same trap that, again, I name checked Double Indemnity earlier, where it's a film where it's like, you can't be charged for the same murder for the same crime twice. She can get away with murdering Bruce Greenwood. Well, no, that's not what that law means.
No, that's Double Jeopardy. Double Indemnity is one.
Yeah, sorry. Double Jeopardy.
Which was remade as Body Heat.
Yeah, but the point being here is...
I don't know why I said so proud of myself right then. Double Jeopardy.
But yeah, that's a film that it's like it hinges on, oh, see, we have a clever understanding of how this law works.
Exactly.
Even though that's not how that law works at all. But again, for a big mainstream audience who may or may not watch a lot of CBS, this is the kind of film where it's dumb, but it... It's the kind of dumb where some people will sit there and look at it and say, oh, that's a smart film. It isn't. It isn't, but it's very good at convincing people that it might be, you know, as long as they don't think about it.
Well, I guess because it uses that same mixture of jargon and sort of pop philosophy and like pop theology, and it crams it all together in a way that, as presented, like, I think it's because, like, if you knew nothing about the law or religion or philosophy, I feel like you could watch this film and not feel like you're being spoken down to. And I think anybody who has a working knowledge of those things will walk into this movie and realize how deeply stupid it is.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, like, I can see a world where it's like John Milton. You know, there's a large chunk of the audience who will have no idea what that's a reference to.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. I hate to say it, but that's the case. I don't think that enough people will be familiar with it to be able to put that together. And I'm saying that that's not a good thing, but how many people out there at large have read Milton's works? Do you honestly think it's a big number?
Well, what is a big number anyway, David?
I would say that enough that it was basically the mainstream.
There's literally unlimited numbers.
Yes. My point being here that...
And what are we... This movie has broken our podcast.
Yeah, so take that, Atomic Blonde. But, I mean, actually, it might be the Robaxacet that's breaking the podcast. The point being here that, in this instance, yes, this film is, I mean, it is everything that we've said over the course of this episode. It is dumb, it is goofy, it is silly, it's fun, it's annoying, it drags its, you know, it is filled with problematic things that will make you uncomfortable. It's all of the above, and what's really going to settle your enjoyment of it is which of these things probably appeal to you or doesn't bother you as much as anything else. I honestly can't predict what a person's reaction to it is. I can say that the 7.5 out of 10 on the Internet Movie Database that this has overall is absurd. I guess there's
no accounting for taste.
Yes,
this film also cost $50 million to make and made $150 million back, so clearly we're kind of in the minority on this one.
Yes, now we should note that's the overall box office from around the world. In America, it only pulled in around, I believe, $53 to $55 million, somewhere in there. So the
That's only $53 to $55 million more dollars than I have.
Fair point. So yeah, I mean, this film was enough of a hit at the time. It wasn't a massive hit, but it was a solid, respectable number there. And I mean, Hackford would get to go on making more films. Pacino would get to go on making more films. Keanu Reeves would eventually have his renaissance where everybody now treats him almost like a deity in terms of at this point in time. So I mean, everybody worked out
fine. See, that would be a great segue to talk about next week's film. But sadly,
yeah,
we have to finish talking about this one first. But it's interesting that you you bring up perfect numbers, because I think the perfect number is 2, which is the number of hits and pits that we usually come up with a piece for our patent-pending bumper segment.
Absolutely. So, Andrew, what would be your first hit for this film?
I would probably give it to Keanu Reeves' performance, as much as I have been goofing on it all episode. I think he's really I think he hits above the material he's given. Yeah, I mean, I don't think I need to go on more than that. What about you, Dave? What's your first hit?
Okay, there's, in terms of the ridiculousness of this movie, there is one scene of Al Pacino's performance that needs to be highlighted for the glory that it is.
Okay, which one?
Following Eddie Barzun's funeral, after Kevin has left, Lomax is in the back, or John Milton's in the back of the church. And yes, he looks up at some of the images of the angels up in the stained glass windows. And then Pacino, in full glorious mode, takes his finger, hovers it over a bowl of holy water, and with a great big grin, almost looking at it, it's like, huh, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it, folks. I'm going to stick my finger into this holy water. Just wait till you do it. And sure enough, he does. And we get a ridiculous amount of special effects that sort of stem from this as this is happening, with the water boiling. And I believe Weaver's getting run down at the same time. And again, Pacino's just like a kid in a candy store. He's so happy. It's like, I'm being naughty. I'm being very, very naughty.
Did him boiling the holy water cause that car to run Wheeler over?
I don't know if it caused it or not, but the point of the matter is it's implied as a possibility, and he just seems so happy with himself as he's doing it.
Cobra's like, one stone.
Exactly. But it's just, it's like, there's something so absurdly childlike about this interpretation, yeah, which is completely different. It's very
much thumbing your nose at your parents when they turn their back.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's so dumb. It's so dumb and so gloriously funny. So that's my first hit in this one. Andrew, hopefully you have something more substantial than that.
Delroy Lindo, he gets a lot of mileage out of staring intensely at people and taking things out of the fridge. And Charlize Theron, I think her character is woefully underdeveloped, but, you know, in her drama scenes, like, she carries it well, and in her fun scenes, she carries that well, too. I felt bad for her more than anything, as opposed to just angry like I did with the rest of the cast, so, yeah. Hats off to her. I mean, she's another of the cast that proved very resilient over time. And it's good to see that she's now getting the kind of roles that speak to her abilities as both an actress and an action star.
Yes, absolutely. So to give a little bit of a final one last hit here, Andrew, you might sit there and wonder, you might notice that most releases of this film now are listed as the unrated director's cut. And yet, the film is the exact same length as the version that was released in theaters. So do you know why this film was unrated when it hit home video?
I honestly don't. Because my version seemed inordinately long, but I couldn't be bothered to look up if there were different cuts.
There, technically, yes, but not really. Because what ended up happening was, remember that big sort of display behind Al Pacino's chair in the tower there that ends up coming to life during the climax?
Oh my god, did they George Lucas it?
Well, what happened was, is basically, apparently it was influenced by a real statue or sculpture that was built, and they were sued by the creator of that sculpture about its unfair, its unapproved use. So all versions basically on home video now, the suit was settled, but rather than just pay money, basically every single scene that we see in the film prior to the climax, all the individuals who were in the big wavy sort of water stuff that were part of the original sculpture were digitally removed at every single point.
Because it looks so weird for the rest of it. Where, like, I thought it was a physical statue, but I'm like, there's something off about just the visual appearance of it. But why would they just render a thing to put on the wall? And that makes sense now.
Yeah, and I will say this. They did a magnificent bang-up job, for the most part, of accomplishing it. Because, yeah, I mean, you honestly, if you watched this film and you didn't know that they were there beforehand, you wouldn't see it. So, from what I understand, I don't think the film is...
Well, no. Instead, it just creates this weird visual gap where it's like, why does that thing not look like it should?
See, and I find, I mean, honestly, that kind of works for me. Whereas I'm looking at this thing, it's like, something's off about this. And it does add kind of an unsettling, something's weird thing to it. Oh, I get what you're saying. So for me, it kind of works. You know, obviously it wasn't the intent, but it pulls it off. And as I understand it, the film, they just... I don't think they resubmitted it after the digital effects to have it rated again. So I think the only reason it's listed as unrated that I can find is basically because the version with the digital manipulation was never rated by the MPAA. That's it. Everything else about this film is the exact same. So yeah, kudos to the effects artist.
That's insane. That, wow.
Yeah. So this brings us to the pits in this instance. So, Andrew, I'm sure you have something that you haven't said yet about this one.
Refer to everything I've said over the course of this episode. David, we've done it again. We spent way too long talking about a movie. I hate this movie. It is so stupid. I wasted 2.5 hours of my life. I'm angry. It just, ugh. This film is a distillation of so many bad elements of 1990s cinema, and it's all just put up on screen, and it's done so in the form of Al Pacino, like, having the time of his life. Look at me, I'm untouchable, Hollywood! Thumbing his nose at the audience, being like, I'm having a great time, aren't you having a great time? Look, we're gonna go to a restaurant, you can see me dance, That'll be fun, won't it? It's like the aggressive stepdad that really, really wants to get along with you on that first vacation together.
So this has been Film Strips, the episode in which we discover what is it like when Andrew has no filters thanks to a combination of medications to deal with neck pain. So, Yeah, I think if nothing else, this episode has been totally worth it for that. So,
well, I mean, I had fun doing it. I rarely ever get, like, winded because I'm either laughing or ranting so hard about The Devil's Advocate. David, what about you, though? Do you have any pits that you would like to single out?
In the interest of keeping...
You can think of a few.
In the interest of keeping... One. Yeah, I will give you... Well, two. One is there is that scene where Christabella and Kevin are out on the basically the balcony looking out during the party.
He's got
the terrible, terrible green screen of the backdrop of New York at night. It is so obviously fake.
Yeah.
Couldn't they
have waited 6 hours?
It really is baffling. Like, I just don't get why it's that way or why they couldn't have shot it at another, you know, at night or anything. It's bad. It's really, really bad.
Well, they shoot day for night, but then they get sued by Truffaut as well.
Fair enough. But with that, I mean, beyond that, the other thing to, well, okay, I'll do quick, fire off two very quick ones. One, as I already mentioned, Connie Nielsen's hairstyle in this film, bad. So bad.
Well, you get a lot of mileage out of a $1.30.
Yeah, true. And then three, last but not least, Don King.
Yeah, the Don King cameo. Yeah. Which is gross because at one and the same time, it's like, ha ha, he's a scumbag promoter. No wonder he knows Satan. On the other hand, it's like, yeah, let's have a big old rib tickler about a guy who went to prison for beating a man to death and then spend the rest of his life exploiting people in his care.
Yeah, so that one was awkward, to say the least.
What next? Sean Spicer on Dancing with the Stars? All is forgiven because you recognize you look silly.
Yeah, yeah, so,
Wow, if this is your first episode, I'm sorry.
I almost feel like we need to record our special Christmas ad right after this, because I don't know if there's going to be a better time. But, so yeah, that's...
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so that is...
So for our Christmas ad and other wonderful content that you can pick up week by week, let's say in lieu of the episodes, though, which you can hear mostly every Tuesday... you can also follow along with us on Twitter, but I guess first we should probably say what the next movie is.
Well, let's complete the Twitter thing first, because you can find me at 24panels, and if you want to find a much more lucid version of Andrew, where can they do so?
You can find me at Filmstripper. You can also email our show all your feedback at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. And if you ever want to join us for an upcoming episode and keep us on the straight and narrow, feel free to get in touch with us. We're cool.
Yeah, we'll go with that. with that, Andrew, where are we going next time on this little program of ours?
Well, you know the only thing better than a 1990s Keanu Reeves movie?
What's that?
Two of them. So we're going to follow him to Bernardo Bertolucci's Little Buddha from 94, I believe?
I believe it is 94, yes. So, yeah, and if you're wondering...
Yeah, so I know nothing about this movie other than it's called Little Buddha and it has Keanu Reeves in it, and it's made from Bernardo Bertolucci.
It's also got Chris Isaac making his second appearance on the show, so good for it. But the I will say this. This is the episode that basically began as a joke comment I made on Twitter and has snowballed into a real thing. So for more details on that, please tune in next episode.
Yeah, it'll be our snakes on a plane. And as always, though, you can follow, you can catch our show each and every week on iTunes, Podomatic, or whatever other podcasting service that you use. You can also rate and review our show. 5-star reviews help move us up the promoted chart and get new eyes and ears onto our show. And that's another spot to leave feedback, because your feedback is important, believe it or not, because David and I strive to bring you the kind of show that you want to listen to, and some weeks like this one, we apologize deeply for missing that mark.
Did we, or did we just abuse everybody? We'll soon find out. With that, Andrew, do you have any parting words for our listeners?
Dave, you know that I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Only, though, if Keanu Reeves shoots himself in the head first, and then, yeah, it's like, guess that's going to happen. Or time travel, you tell me.
Oh, that was a slog. Oh, guess I should stop recording.
'Cause my mind is fading, and everywhere I look there's a dead end waiting. Temperatures dropping at the rotten oasis, stealing kisses from the lepers' faces. Heads are hanging from the garbage man trees, mouthwash, jukebox, gasoline. Pistols are pointing at a poor man's pockets, smiling eyes with them out of the sockets. Got a devil's haircut in my mind, got a devil's haircut in my mind, got a devil's haircut in my mind, got a devil's haircut in my mind.
special places?